I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I get it. You know, Thanksgiving is going to be different this year. I mean, my annual tradition is to actually fly to Minnesota, stay there to host our live Thanksgiving call-in show, Turkey Confidential, then rush out of the studio like the minute it's over to catch a flight back to New York that gets me walking into my neighbor's house just as the pies come out. I kiss my wife, kiss my kid, have a slice, and that's my version of the holiday. And you know, this year, I actually get to be at home because we're pre-taping Turkey Confidential thanks to COVID. But you know what? I'm going to miss my weird version of Thanksgiving this year because I love talking to you all on that day. And I'm sure a lot of you are going to miss your traditions, your nieces, your uncles, your parents, or your kids. And honestly, I think there are a couple ways to go about this, right? We can focus on the things that are going to be different, or if we can, we can try to focus on the fact that this year, more than most, we have to cherish the things that we have to be thankful for. And when it comes to dinner that night, I think you can lean into the difference. I mean, later in the show, we're going to talk with Dan Souza from America's Test Kitchen on some menu planning ideas and tips on how to downsize your Thanksgiving dinner and still keep it festive. And if you're only going to be one, or two, or three, or four people this year, and you don't have to make the oyster stuffing that, you know, only Uncle Carlos likes, why not switch it all up? We've got cooks from Mexico, Somalia, and Vietnam to talk about how they celebrate Thanksgiving, and they've got ideas for what we can put on our tables this year. Turns out there's a lot of pasta. But let's start with Andrea Nguyen. Andrea's family came to America from Vietnam when she was a little girl. She's since spent a career teaching us about the glories of Vietnamese cuisine. She's kept her blog, Viet World Kitchen, since 2007, and she's written great cookbooks on pho, banh mi, and her latest, Vietnamese Food Any Day. Hey, Andrea.
Hey, Francis.
Hey, how do you normally do Thanksgiving?
You know what? We do a Viet Glish Thanksgiving with my family.
Say that word again.
Viet Glish. It's the language we speak among the Nguyens. You know, probably a lot of Nguyens in this country. But yeah. It's, you know, it's like part, you know, Vietnamese and part stuff that you would know in English.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, growing up, I never really had a traditional Thanksgiving until I met my boyfriend, now husband, which was, you know, like well into my college years, and attended his family's Thanksgiving. But they went out, too, for prime rib. But in my family, we tried turkey when we first came here because we thought, oh, my gosh, you know, we'll be like as American as we could be. But that is a large bird that my mother just never cared for.
And my mother and your mother have at least that in common.
Yeah. And I imagine a lot more. So then, you know, we switched to like roasting ducks or geese or just a really old-fashioned chicken, roast chicken. Because when I was growing up, my mom would say, you know what? If someone came over to your house and you were in Vietnam, you'd say, go kill a chicken. because chickens are really, you know, these like service animals in many ways, in the sense that they were better off laying eggs than being on your table.
You get consistent food for a long time if you let them lay your eggs.
Right. Yeah. And you would probably wait till the chicken was kind of spent before you like harvested the poor animal for eating. Yeah. So we'd have roast chicken. She would make a sticky rice stuffing. Well, sometimes she'd stuff it. And because my mom was a dressmaker America, she taught herself French sewing skills when she was young and made all her own clothes. And she still does today. But she would get out needle and thread and beautiful, you know, like bright red thread. And she would sew the bird up. So it had like these beautiful sutures.
Beautiful isn't right. That sounds a little macabre, but okay.
I mean, right off of Halloween, right? I mean, just like beautiful stitches. And so, you know, the bird would get sewn up and stuffed, and we'd always have like leftover dressing that she'd bake. But what she and my dad always did was to have like roasted chestnuts between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's really like, you know, something left over from the French. And they would peel the chestnuts and then simmer them with cilantro and chicken stock or broth. We'd have sweet potatoes, but never mashed potatoes. And that's because she just doesn't like the texture of mashed potatoes. And one of my nieces recently made like smashed potatoes. Mm-hmm. And because my mom like dislikes unpeeled fruits and vegetables, anything that has a skin that can be peeled, she's got to peel it.
Yeah.
Right, because, you know, there's like this old school way of like, oh my gosh, that's dirty, right? I don't know if your family was like that.
Sure, yeah. Actually, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, they I never put two and two together, but yeah, like every fruit had to be peeled. But yeah, I'm sure it had this, it was like a connotation of dirt, yeah.
Right, that's why like my mom won't eat strawberries. So, no strawberries for her.
You live in California. Fine. It's like the greatest strawberries
I know,
I've
and heard. We still get them this time of the year into the fall. She won't touch them. More for me, right?
Yeah, exactly. Man, Andrew, I got to bring us back to that sticky rice stuffing.
Okay.
You talked about, because that sounds so amazing. And, you know, if I wanted to work some Vietnamese dishes into my table this year, what would you tell me to make?
Oh, man, I could just, like, go on and on. You know that. But I would start with, you know, a sticky rice stuffing. And this stuffing is really like a hybrid thing. So it's sticky rice, and then there's shiitake mushroom in there and butter and a little cilantro and roasted chestnuts and also a little bit of the liver from the bird. And, of course, cognac. So my mother doesn't drink, but she will put liquor in her food. So
that sounds so good.
It's really, really nice. And it's so aromatic once that she pulls those sutures from the bird, right? And it just kind of like, you know, there's like this exhalation of this fragrance. And boy, it is really, really good. And when you bake it, it gets like just a slight little crispiness when you bake it, you know, as a side dish in a little casserole dish. It's absolutely wonderful.
Super good.
So, you know, our traditional Thanksgivings are, you know, partly, you know, these kind of Western, partly American-ish foods, but then we would have Vietnamese food. So she would pull out the stops and make, for example, fried cha da, which are rice paper rolls that are fried and served with lettuce and herbs and nook jam dipping sauce. We would have what are called gai salads, which are these special event salads. As of late, we've been roasting crispy pork belly or ribs. She also makes these beautiful stuffed periwinkles. Shells.
How do you stuff a they're tiny, right? They're like, the size of a dime.
The periwinkles that she refers to are West Coast, so things are bigger here, Francis. Okay. So it's really like more like a conch, like a mini conch. And she buys them fresh. And then she does this Northern Vietnamese thing where they're stuffed with like sort of a forcemeat mixture that has chunky shiitake mushrooms in there. And there's this little harness of lemongrass leaves that she gets from her garden. And it makes this wonderful broth that's in the shell once that you use you pull on the harness and the filling pops out.
Oh,
and then
cool.
You drink the broth. And then you dip the filling into this gingery dipping sauce that has like fish sauce in it and lime juice and a ton of ginger.
Oh, man.
And, you know, right.
This
right.
Is
and,
so
and,
cool.
You know, she's 86. She's 86 and she'll still do this stuff. But this year, what I'm really looking forward to is what is probably going to be her last batch of mooncakes. And, you know, you're of Chinese heritage, you know, mooncakes are, you know, harken back to the moon festival, but we eat them year round and my mom makes her own. Her filling has the egg yolk in there, but also like nuts and meats and seeds and sweetmeats and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Well, actually, well, so for folks who don't know, describe a mooncake. I have to confess, like, I know them, like you said, like we would have them during like the Harvest Moon Festival. So for us, growing up in a Chinese household, this was a fall thing. This was a fall harvest festival thing. But frankly, they were never my favorite food, but you sound passionate about them. So tell us about them.
Well, let's just say, starting off, that mooncakes are sort of like, for some people, the bad fruitcake experience, right?
That is very That sounds right to me.
And you know, they're like the size of a large hockey puck, right? And yeah. But and it's a very thin pastry shell that encases a filling. Oftentimes they're solid fillings. They could be like red bean or mung bean or lotus seed paste. And so they're kind of heavy when they're like just those sorts of paste. And in the middle, there is a salted duck egg or chicken egg. And sometimes, and you're lucky, there's like two of them. And so it's sort of like the savory sweet thing. Mm-hmm, but the higher end stuff, man, you know, there's like, it's almost like a mincemeat kind of mixture. And there's liquor in there and finely diced, sweetmeats. So, I mean, it's when you cut it open, a really well-made one. Well, I'm just talking about my mom's, basically. It's like jewel tone, and it's just absolutely wonderful. So this year, the Moon Festival was at the beginning of October. And so my parents were like lurking around my Instagram feed, and then they saw me do something on mooncakes. And then my dad, who's 90, and he says to my mom, "Let's make them one more time." And so she made like four dozen. She just doesn't make like small batch, right? That's just not her style.
That's so many mooncakes.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like mooncakes, you know, for years, and they freeze well too, thank goodness. And so she made them and she mailed them to me, and so I'm really, really going to look forward to eating them, because you know that Harvest Moon Festival is a festival of gratitude.
Sure.
And it's sort of like our Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
You know, and it comes early. So in our Viet Glitch Thanksgiving, it's almost like, you know, a double whammy, double happiness, double Thanksgiving, because, you know, we will do it at like the Moon Festival time, Harvest Festival, and then we'll do it again at American Thanksgiving.
Oh, that's so lovely. It's funny because it's right in the name of the word Thanksgiving, but it's really about expressions of gratitude. And it is something that is so American and feels so American. But the idea of a festival during your harvest season is almost universal. And I love that you have it twice. It's great to talk to you, Andrea.
Hey, you know what? The fall is the best time of the year for food and cooking, and so I'm extra, extra thankful.
Have a great Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Francis.
Andrea Nguyen is the author of Vietnamese Food Any Day, and you can find that recipe for sticky rice stuffing at splendidtable.org. That sounds so good. Coming up, Dan Souza from America's Test Kitchen has advice on cooking Thanksgiving for just a few people while still keeping it a feast. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters.
I am Petra Paradis. I own and operate Petey's Pie Company in the Lower East Side of Manhattan and Petey's Cafe in Clinton Hill, Brooklyn. So this Thanksgiving, we plan on making around 8,500 pies. And I have done this Thanksgiving marathon ever since I was a little kid, because I grew up in my parents' pie bakery in Virginia. So this is something that runs pretty deep for me. And even though I'm making these pies for strangers, most of whom I will never meet, it's a real honor to be part of people's Thanksgiving feasts. And it's an honor that I don't take lightly. So many people make all of their meal from scratch, and then they buy their pie. And I'm so happy to be able to use really good foods to make really delicious pies that people are going to enjoy on Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody, or as we call it at PD's, Happy Pie Super Bowl.
Man, I don't really know Petra Paradis, but I am such a fan of her pies. And she has a book out. It's called Pie for Everyone, and she left us with a recipe for autumn pear pie at our website, splendidtable.org. Anyway, we're talking Thanksgiving today, and if you're like a lot of us and you find yourself cooking for the few instead of for the many this year, Dan Souza from America's Test Kitchen, he's the editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated, is here with some ideas on how to make the most of it. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Francis.
All right, so we are getting just loaded with this question over and over and over again, and I'm sure you are too. So I'm basically going to offload my work and make you do it for me. Because everyone's asking, you know, some variation of, you know, how do I make a Thanksgiving that feels like Thanksgiving? That's festive, but, you know, maybe I don't want to roast a 15-pound turkey for four people. Mm-hmm. You know, do you have thoughts for folks who have to shrink the meal but still want it to feel like a great celebration?
Absolutely. We've been doing a ton of thinking about it. Yeah. You know, and I think you're totally right. Like, everyone's table is probably going to be a little smaller this year. But we really feel like there's no reason not to just pack it with really beautiful, awesome food that feels special. I think there's every year that people need that. It's probably this one. And, you know, there's actually some kind of interesting opportunities in doing a smaller group. You know, if you're cooking for 20, sometimes you're a little bit limited in terms of not only the types of dishes that you can do, but, you know, how challenging they are to cook and kind of pull off for everyone. So we're hoping that, you keep it smaller, you can really make it pretty special.
Oh, cool.
But I've also got some just like really tangible, you know, changes that I think people can do to make it work for them. And the first is, it's all about the bird, right? The bird, like on Thanksgiving, we choose the largest poultry that we can get our hands on oftentimes. but no, it's like, you know, that's like the foundation of this classic meal. And sure. If you remove that, you know, what do you have? But I think it actually opens up this incredible opportunity to do something different. And one thing I'm really recommending to people is go for duck this year instead of turkey. Mm. Duck is rich. I mean, the whole thing is basically dark meat. It's really, really succulent. And they're smaller birds. So, you know, one duck feeds four people. So it's kind of perfect. It feels festive. It feels special. We've got an awesome recipe with a cherry sauce that is just, you know, it feels really, really, really nice. So that's one option. We've been thinking about, you know, if you want to do things where you don't have to carve and have everything kind of buffet style, is to go with game hens. So we have an awesome herb roasted game hen recipe where everyone gets their individual one. Again, it feels kind of nice.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. Game hens are about like a pound and a half.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's kind of like a perfect, like big meal size for one.
Yes, exactly.
Let me bring back to the duck for a second. And then I think we can't entirely avoid the turkey. So I do want to talk a little about turkey.
Yep.
But going back to the duck, like, I love duck. But, you know, one of the problems with people who aren't used to cooking it is how to render the skin, because there's so much fat in the skin, which is a big part of why it's super delicious. But if you don't know how to handle it, it can get flabby, it can feel fatty, it can feel like a little too much.
Absolutely. We use kind of a braise and then roast technique, which does a couple of things. So one is it helps render out a fair amount of fat. It also, I mean, ducks, they're dark meat, like their legs and thighs are really well exercised too. So they have tons of collagen and they can be kind of tough if you just roast the bird straight up. So we do kind of a braising technique, which render some fat, breaks down some of that collagen, and then when it goes in for the roasting part, it's really about crisping the skin and getting that beautiful browning, and then, you know, rendering even more fat during that time as well. But I also totally get that turkey is what sometimes, you know, for a lot of people makes the meal feel right. And we have a nice roast turkey breast with gravy recipe where it feels totally classic. It's much smaller. You'll still have some leftovers for a small group, but it's really nice. Mm-hmm. But my favorite, my absolute pick for this year, and it's what I'm going to be doing, is we have a new recipe for a turkey thigh confit.
Cool.
With this beautiful citrus mustard sauce. And it's, you know, it's pretty classic confit. It gets a cure with aromatics and salt, and then it cooks low and slow in fat. And what's awesome about it is, you know, you can make it really far ahead, but it also freezes incredibly well. So if you make it and you just have a small group, it freeze it and then you can pull it out and you've got this, like, it's the best turkey I've ever eaten. It's succulent. It's super well seasoned. And so you won't get maybe the Norman Rockwell appearance of a whole bird, but every bite is definitely what you're looking for.
But when you say confit, I mean, you mean like literally, like you're basically slow braising it in fat.
Yes, exactly. So we tested a bunch of different fats. You know, duck fat, we really love for the flavor, but pick up some schmaltz at the market too. And if you want, you can actually do it in just like a vegetable oil as well.
Oh, cool.
So you can keep it, you know, really inexpensive. It's the fat itself helps to kind of regulate the temperature, as you know, and just gets this really gentle cooking. But if you do go with something like duck fat, you've got this awesome byproduct that makes the best roasted potatoes. It's great for sautéing and stuff. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have a hard time getting off of doing my turkey this way. I think moving forward, it's so appealing.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a way to miniaturize the turkey. But like, what are some other dishes that you would think about maybe making in miniature, and what dishes might not be worth it?
Yeah. So I feel like that like draws me right to dessert because I've been thinking about this a lot, you know, with like, you know, you want to scale back dessert. But for me, like pie is Thanksgiving and leftover pie is one of the best things in life. So for me, I would go, full bore, do all the pies you normally do. And then, I don't know, you've just got awesome breakfast and dessert for days. So that's my take.
I'm so with you on pie for breakfast.
You are. Okay. Like,
pie is a totally appropriate breakfast food.
It is, right? It's made for it. So I have a friend who calls it bookending. So around the holidays, when you make a pie, you bookend your day. You have it for breakfast, and then you have it for dessert after dinner, and then you just kind of repeat. but I understand, you know, if people do want to shrink down dessert, I think there are some really cool and kind of cute options. And one is going for something like lemon posset, which is this unbelievably simple recipe. It's got four ingredients like cream, sugar, lemon, and lemon zest. The fourth ingredient is like some berries to put on top, but it's a super simple custard. Basically just reduce the cream with the sugar for a little bit and then let it set in ramekins. So they're all individual. You make them ahead and they're silky and rich. There's no eggs in them if that's a dietary concern.
And no gelatin. So can you describe how it sets if there's no eggs and no gelatin?
Yeah, so it's the cooking process and the acidity with the natural protein that's in the cream. And as it cools, it can be a weak gel, like it can be very, very soft, but it depends on how long you cook it and how much water you drive away. But you can make it, almost as thick and creamy as like a cheesecake. It can be really, really dense.
Oh, wow.
But ours is on the lighter side. It's a little easy to eat for how much cream is in it. It just feels really, really light, but also kind of lush.
Beautiful. Dan, it's been great to talk with you, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Souza is editor-in-chief of Cooks Illustrated. And you can find those recipes for roast duck, turkey thigh confit, and lemon posset for a limited time at splendidtable.org. You know, I know next to nothing about Somali food, but I can actually tell you the name of a chef in Mogadishu. His name is Ahmed Jama, and he is most famous for running a restaurant that was targeted and bombed by militants and for insisting on rebuilding and staying open anyway. Now, Chef Jama is amazing, no doubt, but I have to ask myself, why is it that the only food story I know from Somalia is really a story about violence and struggle? That's why I was so happy to get my copy of a new cookbook called In Bibi's Kitchen. The author is Hawa Hassan. She's a Somali-American chef, and Bibi is the Swahili word for grandmother. So it's a collection of histories, interviews, and recipes gathered from grandmothers from Eritrea and Somalia all the way down the coast to South Africa. And the book is a celebration of these women, their lives, and their food. And so I also wanted to ask Hawa, as we think about what we're grateful for, what are some foods that say Thanksgiving to her? Hey, Hawa, it's great to talk with you.
Hi, Francis. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled. So let's start here. You were born in Somalia. You came to the United States at 7, but you didn't grow up in a very Somali community or household. So how did you get your education in Somali culture?
Well, I mean, I'm Somali through and through. And so I'm the eldest of 5 girls and the second eldest of 10 children. And so, it's not something you step into or step out of. It's always in you. I was born in Mogadishu, like, we had talked about, and I was sent to Seattle when I was 7 years old. But I always tell people my formative years were spent on the continent. Like, I went to Seattle as a whole adult.
Well, tell me about that. Tell me about like, do you call on the memories? Do you call on your, those first 7 years? And obviously you've, as an adult, you've gone back to Somalia, but how formative were those years? And can you like tease them out? Cause I couldn't tell you anything about like how I grew up culturally, as a kid. I just kind of like, oh, I'm just kind of me. I wasn't aware of my culture in a way.
Yeah. I mean, my mom and I basically grew up together. She was in her late teens when she had my brother and myself. And so, in Somali culture, there's this thing called Somali nimar, which means it's like it's the essence of who you are. it is what you are. I have friends now that are like, God, your Somali nima is so strong. And I'm like, was it not before? Like, was the essence of me is in being a Somali not strong before? But what they mean is like, you're so rooted in your culture. But when I left Somalia, you know, I went to Seattle as my mother's daughter. And so it was the one thing that I always was able to stand on. It is who I am. Somali parents pride themselves on raising their kids to, you know about their tribes, know the Quran, know how to cook, know how to, you know, straighten up a house. And so that's really what I took to Seattle with me, was this very much formed young person who had just experienced much turbulence, but then had like lots of stability at home in terms of like my mother and my father and my siblings and I were really close. And what was always taught to me was, you know, first and foremost, you're Khadija Usman's daughter, Hussein's daughter, and then you're a human. And so a lot of the way I live my life even now is based on that. I walk every day thinking, if I do that, would my mother be proud? And so before I am a lot of things, I first pride myself on being Khadija Usman's daughter, which is my mom. Yeah. Obviously my mom.
Yeah. That's so powerful. And so your book, In Bibi's Kitchen, so Bibi is a term for grandmother. The book is about the cooking of grandmothers, but not necessarily just about Somali grandmothers. It's women you met from 8 different East African countries, from Eritrea all the way down to South Africa. So many different cultures. First of all, how did you meet these women?
Community. I mean, Frances, I think, you know, you're probably someone who's similar to me in this way, but I really root myself in the places that I'm in. And so, you know, when I got to Seattle, my intentions were, once I realized my family wasn't able to come to Seattle with me, I decided I was going to root myself in that community. I was going to meet the best kids at school. I was going to, you know, hopefully be approved by their parents and get to spend a lot of time in atmospheres that felt different than the way I was growing up in. And so anywhere I've traveled, I'm never a tourist. I pride myself in being somebody who dives into that culture and that place. And I like to see it from the locals' eye. And so a lot of the women in this book come from some of my travels. Some of my dear friends' parents are in here, aunties. And so really community, the backbone of this cookbook is community.
And what did they say? Like, how did they react when you said you wanted to learn to cook their food?
I think originally a bit of like, why, you know, and then followed by excitement of, oh, well, that sounds really nice that you want to preserve these stories and recipes. And then it became like, how do we help Hawa actualize this book? So I just actually got a message from someone in Kenya today, and she said, can you send me the acknowledgement page so I can brag? I mean, this book, everybody feels it's their own, which is so exciting, because that was the original goal going into it, you know, was for people to see themselves really inside this book.
Yeah. And when they were teaching you, did they gravitate towards their everyday foods or their special occasion foods? And this is kind of what I'm sort of, because I'm thinking about Thanksgiving. and, you know, obviously for a lot of people, the Thanksgiving menu here in the United States, the typical quote unquote traditional one, you know, a lot of those are special occasion foods, right?
Like
you're not going to roast a turkey maybe any other point of the year. So and so forth. You know, were there dishes like that? They're like, oh, this is what you would do for a special gathering? Or was it more like, oh, this is our everyday stuff?
So I went into this thinking there will be no perimeters around what these women can say, what they can talk about. I'm not going to censor any Bibi. So, you know, I let them lead the way, but each one of them basically made what they would make every day, you know, or like what they crave or what their favorite food was. Like our grandmother in South Africa made mfino. Mfino is a word in the Xhosa language, and it loosely translates to leafy greens. It usually refers to greens that grow in the wild. Mfino also refers to a meal of those greens typical with onion and seasoning, and it's served with corn porridge. It's a traditional dish usually eaten by women, is what our Bibi in South Africa tells us. She talked about how grandmothers grew that grain, and then they made it so that women can get stronger, which I thought was really interesting. So many older women are passionate about teaching the younger generations about the identities of these greens that grow through South Africa. And you know, how they serve and can be purposeful in like replenishing your iron, etc.
Can you describe the dish?
Yeah, let me. I want to do her justice. I don't want to not hit all her recipes, and so I'm just gonna go to Nfino. I love the way she pronounces it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's wild greens and corn porridge, and in it there is a few cups of water, finely ground white or yellow cornmeal, a little salt, some olive oil, a yellow onion, 2 cloves of garlic, a jalapeno, a small green cabbage, small zucchini, and then some baby spinach.
Oh, I love it.
All of it brought together in a pot and sauteed and olive oil drizzled. And it's incredible. It's healthy. It's, like I said earlier, a dish traditionally eaten by a woman for many reasons. She says back in the day, men were not aware of the nutritional values of green vegetables and didn't eat them because they assumed that it would make them weak.
Interesting.
Isn't that incredible?
Wow. And sometimes you wonder why certain stories and myths about foods come to be. And then it turns out, maybe women really needed the iron, you know, after childbirth. And like, that was a great source of iron. So like those foods were reserved for women. I'm totally making that up here, but
no, that's exactly what she says as well. I mean, in Ethiopia and Eritrea too, there's also another dish. It's basically given to a woman right after she gives birth, and it's supposed to make her strong again and replenish her iron levels. And same thing here. She says the same exact thing, and that's why men didn't eat it, because they thought that it would make them weak. Can you imagine?
Yeah. all right, so if I wanted to cook out of your book for my Thanksgiving table, what would you tell me to make?
Oh, there's so many good ones. I would say, you know, the spiced chicken and onion samosas would be incredible, which is something I love to make at home, and we make it for holidays. It's just a little bit of flour, some warm milk, some canola oil, kosher salt, a baked potato, a yellow onion, a red pepper, cloves, Hawash spice, which is the backbone of Somali cooking. It is a spice combination really reflective of the Indian Ocean, made with coriander, cumin, cinnamon, turmeric. It's a spice mix made of like 6 things. And with that, you know, I know you know what samosas are. Some places they're called sambusas. Some places they're called samosas. It's a dough, and then some are made vegetarian style, some are made with beef, some are made with ground turkey. It's just a triangle dough that you fill and then you fry and set aside. And usually you break fast with it during Ramadan, or you can eat it for any holiday. In Tanzania, oftentimes the Muslims dine with the Christians dine with the Muslims for Eid and iftar.
Oh, cool.
And so they eat this together. It's a labor of love, as it takes a little bit long to make.
Yeah.
But I would make that for a holiday. I would also, you know, I would also make our sugo sugar, which is a Somali pasta sauce with beef. It speaks to the colonization of Somalia through the Italians. You know, what they left behind for us was pasta, but then we jazzed it up with our warm spices. Ooh. So I would make that, which is super easy to do and, you know, doesn't take long to make, but also tastes very different from traditional pasta sauce because of the spice mix.
Oh, that sounds so good. Like so warm and like kind of sweet, but oh yeah.
Sweet and okay, savory.
I'm not going to wait till Thanksgiving to do that one.
I bet you have everything that you need in here in your pantry. It's just olive oil, garlic cloves, bell pepper, red onion, ground beef, the hawach spice, which you can make from scratch, some salt, tomato paste, a whole tomato, and then just some spaghetti. You've got all of that,
word,
Francis.
Word, word. This weekend. We're talking this weekend. All right, Hawa, thank you so much. It's great to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Hawa Hassan's book is in Bibi's Kitchen. You can find her recipe for spiced chicken and onion samosas, which include the recipe for the Somali spice mix Hawash, at splendidtable.org. And coming up, we get a Oaxacan American take of Thanksgiving. No, not turkey and mole, but how about spaghetti and poblano pepper cream? I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're talking about Thanksgiving today with friends from around the country, and next we head to L.A. to talk to Bricia Lopez from the Oaxacan restaurant Geligetza. And I'll be honest, I figured we should talk to her about Thanksgiving because her moles are some of the most delicious I've ever had. And because in Oaxaca, turkey is traditionally served in mole, but it turns out that she and her family usually have different plans for Thanksgiving. Hola, Bricia.
Hi, Francis. How are you?
I'm great. Hey, congratulations on your baby.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Obviously, I think she's the most precious thing in the world, but she's my baby. So,
of course.
She's the most beautiful thing ever.
My baby. I'm so excited to talk to you about Thanksgiving because I actually love asking the children in immigrant families when they started doing Thanksgiving. You know, because it's not like, mm-hmm. When I was a kid, we always went to my grandma's house, so like we always did it. You know, at some point, your family had to decide to start doing Thanksgiving. So what were your childhood Thanksgivings like?
Oh my God, it's so true. I never really thought about it that way. Like, my children are growing up with Thanksgiving, and I just sort of took it as when in my teenage years.
Yeah, yeah.
We started celebrating Thanksgiving, I want to say I was 14, 15. I remember the home we were living in.
Okay.
For sure. And it was one of those things that as we were living here, after being here for, I want to say 5 years or so, we realized that it was a big deal. Mm-hmm. We're like, if people take this Thanksgiving like very serious. And the restaurant was pretty, you know, empty that day after a certain time.
Mm.
And that was like the one day my dad started closing early because it was Thanksgiving. And like, what do we do? Maybe we should join in this Thanksgiving situation happening.
Okay.
And my mom, who's the chef of the family, obviously she would, she took it upon herself to really master these very traditional Thanksgiving meals that she would never otherwise learn how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
So the grocery store was Gelson's. So she would go to Gelson's and, you know, then the checkout stand, there were a lot of magazines. You know, once it gets to be holiday time,
yeah, yeah,
you have these, what do you call it? Like holiday, holiday magazines.
Yeah,
right?
Just like all the seasonal magazines that start showing up. Yeah.
Yes. So like how to make the best this and how to make the best that and all those, you know, tips and tricks, very Martha Stewartish. So she would buy a lot. To my mom, when she buys something, it's like she has to have 5 of each thing. Now I know where I get it from. So we're very much the same. And she would get a lot of magazines. She would go through them and she would get very traditional recipes. So when we started our Thanksgiving, it was very much American traditional Thanksgiving. I mean, you like know, the stuffing, the cranberry sauce, the more like sourdough. I wouldn't call it white bread per se, but it was pretty, I would say, traditional. Mm-hmm. Like what you see on those checkout stand magazines.
Yeah, very Martha Stewart.
Right, but for example, the stuffing, my mom adds chorizo instead of sausage because she's like, sausage is a little bit bland. So she would add that, right? And, you know, the cranberry also like, it's a little bit more this and more that. And she would add her little nuances to these recipes. And as time went by and, you know, and evolved and we moved from one house to the next, we started having more people over and it became a thing. And then one year she started making this green spaghetti that everyone just I remember the first year she made it, everyone was like, what is this? And it became like the star of the show. And it became this thing that that became like our Thanksgiving thing, which is non-traditional. You know.
So how do you actually make it?
So the green spaghetti is fairly easy to make. So you just grab a couple of poblano peppers, but you roast them. You char them directly over fire. You peel the skin off. You char onion, garlic. And the garlic, I like to keep the skin on just because I feel like it adds a little bit more depth of flavor, like smokiness of that garlic.
Cool.
And like
because it burns a little bit
yeah,
more?
Yeah, it burns.
Yeah, yeah.
So you just blend all that together with a little bit of milk, crema, salt, pepper, and then you cook it down just for just like a tad bit with butter, obviously. And
obviously.
Yeah, duh. What else would you use on Thanksgiving? There's like no rules. And yeah. It's just creamy. I want to say it's like 1 degree away from being spicy. And again, the kids eat this. So they may say, I think, you know, if you have like a 2-year-old, they'll be like, oh, it's a little spicy, but they'll have like 3 bites. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's spicy.
It's like starter spicy.
Right. Correct. Is what I would call very mild in our home, but it's just adds that creamy and, you know, hearty, perfect carb, you know, item that you want to have in your Thanksgiving table.
Oh yeah. That sounds good. So basically, those pureed poblanos, chard, onion, garlic, butter, cream, the crema, like the Mexican cream, like almost like sour cream. And then you just toss it with spaghetti.
Yep. Well, actually we specifically use Salvadorian cream for this recipe.
Oh, cool.
We don't use Mexican crema. We use Salvadorian cream, which tends to be just a tad bit saltier than your regular Mexican crema and thicker.
Okay.
But I personally love Salvadorian cream, and I have that in my pantry all the time in my fridge.
Oh, that sounds good.
And this is, I believe, this started when parents had already moved to Oaxaca, so they would fly back on Thanksgiving, which is really weird to think about. If you think about, you know, they migrated here with nothing, they moved back to Mexico, but the one holiday they come and travel is for Thanksgiving, which is really interesting. We love it. Sure. Like, our family just loves Thanksgiving, and it has everything to do with food and family. For us, it became the day that my dad closed a restaurant and we got to eat, and my mom got to cook once again for the family and not for the restaurant, you know? So she did this in one of these trips that she would come and make it. And then she brought these jalapenos with her, these canned pickled jalapenos from the store. They're probably like 25 cents a can or something. Yeah. If you turn it to dollars. They're from this particular brand, La Morena, and you can find it here at every Latino store. You can totally find it. And that's the brand I still to this day have in my pantry.
Okay.
But it's really hard to find the red kind.
Okay.
And then it's so funny because at first she only brought like a couple of cans. She's like, oh, okay, it's hard for me to find these cans. I'll bring two. They were gone within minutes of the dinner. And the next year she brought like more and more cans.
So they're just, okay, so green spaghetti, which I'm a little obsessed with. And then there's like turkey and cranberry sauce and, you know, mashed potatoes or whatever.
And beans. And then refried beans, for sure. Yeah. You have to have beans because we have this thing to, number one, when my family eats, it's almost like, you know, when you go eat Korean barbecue and you have all this banchan and you have all these things in the table.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, this is what it looks like in my home every single time my family and I get together to eat. There are dozens of sides because we all strive. And I think it's just based on competition. We all like strive to have the perfect bite, right? Everyone's like, my bite's going to be better than your bite. So how can you layer more flavors? So for us, like, the way we prepare, but the way we all get together.
It's a strange family dynamic, but sure.
I know, but we all get together and we are kind of like, look at each other like, why did you put that? Like, why did you put that on your bite? And it's like, okay, this is the way you're supposed to eat it. And it's so funny because my son is 5 years old and he already tells me like how I should prepare my bite. But the way I prepare my bite, which I think it's the best way to prepare your bite and our Thanksgiving dinner table. So we get a bread, and it's usually a really great bread. I'm sure this year we'll have sourdough again. And then we layer it with, like, the first layer is like this bean paste, right? That my mom makes, like refried bean paste with avocado leaves, very traditional Oaxacan bean paste.
Yeah.
Then you add the turkey. You know, the turkey has, you know, you shred it a little bit in your plate, and it's juicy and, you know, beautiful and salty and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Then you add stuffing to the bite, cranberry sauce. You dabble a little bit of the mashed potato. gravy, a jalapeno, like maybe two of those pickled jalapenos.
Oh, those pickled jalapenos. Okay.
Yeah. You take about two bites. Then with the fork, you grab your spaghetti and you put it in your mouth at the same time while you're chewing this, you know, sandwich taco hybrid.
Yeah,
Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Right on.
And then when you're like left with like two, like maybe one bite left before you swallow, you take a chug of like a very nice wine or a beer. And then like you're like, yeah, this is what Thanksgiving is all about.
That is extremely specific, but I am so happy for you to have that.
Everyone's like, that sounds disgusting. No,
no. So I feel you. I feel you. And yeah. I'm excited for you to have it. I'm excited for your baby to see it. And
it's going to be a little bit different. We won't have as many people as we normally would. Because I just love having friends over so they can experience these bites with us. Mm-hmm. So it would just be, you know, direct family, my siblings and I.
Well, I'm glad you get to have your family with you this year, and congratulations again on your baby. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, Francis. Happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Patricia Lopez is the author of Oaxaca, Home Cooking from the Heart of Mexico. And her family's restaurant is Galleguetza in Los Angeles. And this is just not a plug, but a deep personal recommendation. You can mail order her jars of mole at ilovemole.com. They're amazing. I would not be sad if anyone gave them to me as a gift. They're just terrific. And you can have your Thanksgiving turkey with them, even if Patricia doesn't. So a minute ago, when Patricia Lopez was talking about her perfect Thanksgiving bite, and she said...
And then when you're like left with like one bite left before you swallow, you take a chug of like a very nice wine.
Well, that got us thinking that we should wrap up the show with a little wine advice.
I'm Elizabeth Schneider, host of the Wine for Normal People podcast and author of the book Wine for Normal People. And every year when you are a wine person, people love to ask, hey, what should I have with my Thanksgiving meal? And the answer I always have is something they don't like, which is it's such a complex meal. You need to have more than one wine on the table. Now, this year, let's think about helping some people out because it has been a very, very tough year for wineries in America. We had the fires in Napa and Sonoma. We had an early terrible frost in Virginia, which almost ruined their industry. The Finger Lakes has had problems too. So I'm going to recommend four wines that we're going to take you through the meal, and we're all going to help our fellow Americans out with these wines. First, sparkling wine. I know we don't usually think of sparkling wine from Virginia, but let me tell you, if you have not explored the Monticello AVA from Virginia around Charlottesville, Afton Mountain, Bolinchine, an amazing wine. It will be perfect for your appetizers, for the beginning soups. It's going to cut through some of that cream, some of the heaviness. Fantastic wine. And if you want, you can keep it around for dessert too. For the main course, you really need a white and a red to kind of go through all of that food that's going to be savory and heavy. Some's going to be sweet. Riesling, Smith Madrone. My friends at Smith Madrone, their winery almost burned to the ground on Spring Mountain in Napa. They make Riesling that is lively and fresh and like limes. And it has that aromatic quality. It's going to go great with everything that is really heavy with butter, but also it can handle some of those sweeter dishes like your sweet potatoes and things like that. And for red, Cabernet Franc, Acorn from the Russian River Valley of Sonoma. It is such a great all-rounder. It's going to go great with the turkey and with the stuffing, with gravy. It has enough acidity to break through some of that heaviness, but also nice complementary flavor. And finally, you need a dessert wine because dry wine with dessert is icky. So go for a sweet wine. Anthony Road in the Finger Lakes cultivates Vignol, which is this strange grape that really only you can find in the Finger Lakes. They have a late harvest 2019. It's like $24. It's a great entry your meal. Pecan pie, anything creamy. It'll even stand up to chocolate. Great acidity, fantastic flavor. Those are my picks. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And cheers. Let's all raise a glass to the firefighters and all the first responders who have done so much for us this year.
That's Elizabeth Schneider, author of Wine for Normal People and the podcast of the same name. You can find her wine picks at splendidtable.org. And that is our show. Thanks for listening. Happy Thanksgiving to you from all of us. May you have much to be thankful for. Stay safe, wear your mask. We'll talk to you on Thanksgiving Day on Turkey Confidential. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media. You can listen to all our podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, wherever you like to get them. And sign up for a weekly email called Weeknight Kitchen. It gets a recipe into your inbox every Wednesday to make dinner time a little easier. Sign up at splendidtable.org. Our show comes together because of our team, Jenny Lubke, Erica Romero, and Sally Swift. Stay safe, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.